Today's Taisho will be on case 49 in the Pienlu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 49 is entitled San Shou's The Golden Carp is Out of the Net. Engo's Introduction. Seven piercings and eight breaking through, seizing the drums and capturing the banners, 100 barriers and 1,000 checkpoints, watching the front and guarding the rear, holding the tiger's head and securing its tail. Even all these are not comparable to the veteran master's ability. The ox head disappearing, the horse head appears. That also is not a great wonder. Tell me, what do you do when a person of transcendent experience comes? See the following. Main subject. Sancho said to Seppo, the golden carp is out of the net. Tell me, what will it feed on? Seppo said, when you have got out of the net, I will tell you. Sancho said, a renowned teacher of 1,500 monks cannot even find one word to say about this topic. Seppo said, I'm the chief abbot and I have much to attend to. Secho's verse, the golden carp comes out of the net. Don't say it remains in the water still. It shakes the heavens and moves the earth, swinging its fins, lashing its tail. It blows like a whale, raising great waves. Then the thunder sounds, and a cool breeze comes. A cool breeze, yes, a cool breeze comes. Who in the whole universe knows this? So this is the last day of our beautiful spring session, spring 2008. And I want to thank everybody for doing an excellent job. People have really been sitting deeply, and it's been wonderful to practice with all of you. We have a few precious hours left, and much can be accomplished. So please continue to practice with diligence. You have all done a wonderful job, and I hope that this koan resonates with you just a little bit. Maybe you're not quite out of the net, and maybe you're a little bit out, and maybe you're out and you're swimming around in the great sea. So, but at any rate, Zen practice is, as I was saying yesterday, about seeing the world as it actually is, and not as our culture and our mental habits encourage us to regard it. The other day I was reading an article about elephants communicating. And it was an amazing article because, as you may know, elephants are quite intelligent, you know. They have very, very large brains. And in order for human beings to continue to believe in their superiority, they have to calculate what's called a brain-to-body ratio. So even though the elephant's brain is much bigger than ours, we've figured out a way to deny that that's important. So what we do is we go, yes, it's bigger, but the body's bigger too. This is true. So biologists have something called the brain-to-body. So there, it is bigger, but our brain-to-body ratio is bigger. So we're still on top. And by the way, they've done the same. The biggest brain on the planet belongs to whales, right? Whales have the biggest brains on the planet. There's more white matter and more gray matter and more of the connecting tissue in a brain of a whale than in any other creature on Earth. So we don't actually know how to measure how intelligent they are. Same problem with elephants, right? We discovered, whales have many extraordinary qualities that we can't quite understand. But here too, we've calculated that even though their brains are bigger than our bodies, their body to brain ratio is smaller than ours. Then, of course, the whale specialists have come back and said, yes, but, see, they've said, but the whale is floating in the water. So buoyancy means that you need to calculate its weight in a different way. See? And if you calculate, and they do this with dolphins too, this is fascinating to me. They said, you calculate the dolphin's buoyancy, you factor that in, their brain-body ratio is about the same as ours. You know, I think that's fascinating. So anyway, we are desperate to stay on top. Maybe you also saw this thing the other day. There was it was in the newspaper about how chimpanzees beat humans in certain kinds of intelligence tests. Yeah, this really happened. It turns out that chimpanzees can keep track of more items, numerically, more items at once than we can. Isn't that interesting? They beat us hands down, right? And so they're more intelligent than we are. In this, if you define intelligence in this particular form of intelligence, and they beat us soundly, you know. And they said it's probably because, you know, chimps have to be able to keep track of where all the other chimps are and where the predators are. So they're able to, and they have, you know, many dimensions. They have people up in the, there's monkeys up in the, they're not monkeys, there's chimps up in the trees, you know, there's cheetahs down on the ground, and you've got to know there's three chimps here and two chimps here and, you know, two cheetahs here. So they can hold in their minds many more numbers in groups of numbers than we can. And the tests were really like, it wasn't just that they weren't testing chimps against, you know, young humans. They were testing them against, you know, smart human beings, and the humans were crushed by the chimps. So there's a lot we don't know about our own intelligence or intelligence or awareness. And one of the things we didn't know is that elephants can communicate over huge distances, huge. And they make sounds that are so low that we can't hear them. You know, isn't that fascinating? And these very low vibrating frequencies can travel over enormous distances. And like miles and miles. So, you know, a human is just sitting in his, you know, lawn chair and to see some elephants, and then the elephants suddenly turn and do something, and I wonder why that happened, you know, and we don't hear these very low frequencies, you know, and you can imagine, you know, 20 years ago, somebody speculating about how, you know, how did those elephants know there was water over here, you know? Those elephants were 30 miles away. Somehow, they found this water where the other elephants were. And if somebody had said, well, maybe the elephants at the water communicated with them, right? People would have laughed you off. You know, they said, are you out of your mind? That's science fiction, right? That's science fiction. And yet, you know, it turns out that that's exactly what happens, you know? The elephants send out very low frequency sounds, they're low frequency, and they travel very easily over great distances, and other elephants pick them up, and it says, you know, water over here, you know, 50 miles north, and they head up, you know. So it turns out that elephants are able to communicate in ways that we can't even be aware of. And I think this is a good, you know, in my opinion, you just can't trust common sense, right? Because so many things we believe firmly with great conviction are based upon prejudice and not experience and not reality, you know. So if even 5 years ago somebody had said elephants can communicate over long distances, people would have said that's impossible, you know. And now they have the evidence. Now, the problem for us is that we can't hear these sounds. So that the world of elephant communication is totally invisible to us. And as it turns out, there's other kinds. Did you know that mice communicate in very complicated ways too, and many of the sounds they make we can't hear. Mice sing. Did you know that? No, they sing. You know, we hear them squeak, right? But you know, whales in the water sing, right? Whales create songs. They pick up songs from other whales and they create variations on these. And the songs travel all over the planet, you know? So as the whales go and meet other whales, they trade songs. And they pick up, you know, riffs, you know, from the other whales, you know? And incorporate them into their songs, you know? And it turns out, you know, mice do this too, you know? And we couldn't hear it because they're at the upper frequency, you know? So the whale is too low for us to notice. And the mice are too high. And all this time, you know, we thought these dumb little mice, you know, were just stumbling along when they're really saying, you know, cheese over here, you know, we just couldn't hear it, you know. We have mice in our house, by the way. And they got into the doll recently. And it was so cute because the builders are replacing the window. We've been fixing this house. We used to do sesshin at our house, someday we're planning to sell the house and maybe use that money for a Zen center or something like that. So when we first bought it, it was quite a wreck, as a matter of fact. But we've been fixing it up quite a bit, and one of the things we're doing is replacing the windows now, because the windows are literally falling down. About 10 years ago, I repaired them with epoxy, but now, you know, they're just literally, I'm just afraid they're going to, you know, the panes are going to fall out onto the ground. So we're replacing the windows, and the builders took out one of the old windows. And when they took the window out, under the window, there was a pile of lentils, of yellow lentils, you know? This was on the second floor. So the little mice go down to the basement where I keep the doll, and they got in and they took them, you know, they were taking them in their mouths, you know, all the way up to the third floor. And they put, you know, or the second floor, and they put them, you know, they had a little house under the window, you know? And so there was like this, you know, they were scratching their heads, like, what are these lentils doing here, you know? So they must have been saying, down here, you know, and we couldn't hear it, you know? So the point is, we have a very limited understanding of the world with our ordinary awareness, in my opinion. And if you ask people, if you asked somebody 2 years ago, what do you think? Do you think Mike's saying? You know, you could just hear somebody going, oh, come on, you know, that's ridiculous. But mice sing, you know, and elephants could communicate over long distances. So we can't know this because our senses, you could say, are too crude, you know, too limited and too crude. No matter how long we sit on the cushion, it's probably the case that we can't hear elephants. But I don't know. It would be worth a try, right? but there's a lot we don't pick up on because of the way our ordinary mind works. There's a lot of information we don't pick up on. If you begin to watch your mind as you go through the day, you will notice how often you're involved in a kind of dream state, right? In other words, p- people go through the day constantly constructing little dreams, little stories about themselves. There was a guy on the radio the other day who was a comedian, and he was talking about his life. And he said that when he was a kid, he actually had this fantasy that he was going to grow up to be president of Israel and leader of the world Jewish people. That's how he was like seven, you know. And so he said, I kept these meticulous diaries. Really, the kid, he's a very funny comedian. I can't remember his name. I hadn't really heard of him. And he said, I kept these meticulous diaries. And because I knew I was writing for posterity. Isn't that amazing? This kid, it's like, that's amazing. You know, so he says, of course they'll want to know what I was thinking at my birthday party. You know? I thought that was amazing, right? You know, well, oh my God, even then, you know, he saw, you know. And he said the diaries are full of things like, world brotherhood, you know, this kind of stuff, you know, and leading my, you know, people, you know, out of their confusion, you know, and this kind of stuff, you know, and of course he didn't become president, you know, he lives in the Bronx or something, and he's a stand-up comedian, but and when we heard, you know, hearing that, it's like, it's so funny because of course we all do that, you know, we all do that, you know, there's a book by a guy named James Joyce and called Ulysses. I wouldn't recommend that you read it. but there's a character in the book who is basically he sells advertising, and he sells advertising, and he and his wife had a child who died. And after their child died, I guess their relationship fell apart. And they're still technically married, but his wife has affairs with other people, and he's become like impotent. They were traumatized by this very painful event, and he's sort of a marginal person in his society, and he has to go around selling advertising all day, and it's not that interesting a job. And it sort of follows him through the day, and it's just following his thoughts through the day, and it's very accurate, you know, because he at various points in the thing he has fantasies of, like, you know, leading a revolution, and basically becoming like president of Europe. You know, and what he's thinking about, what would I do? You know, I'd have to do this, I'd have to do that. And then he gets worried. You know, if I'm president of Europe, they'll have to do this, but that won't work. I can't do that. You know, and getting nervous about what he's going to do when he's president of Europe, right? You know, and again, it's very charming and almost heartbreaking, right? Because his life is so difficult, you know, and he's a basically very good guy. He's a very nice man. And yet he has a lot of stresses and strains, and so he just creates like these dreams of, you know, having power and so on, being safe, and humans do this, you know, but even though they reassure us, you know, there's real problems with living in the dream world, because you become sort of like the prisoner of your dreams, you know? And most of your dreams aren't, you know, if you watch and you look at your dreams, most of them aren't going to come true. There's no way. I mean, there's no way that this guy could become president of Europe, right? That's not going to happen, because, of course, there isn't a president of Europe, you know? You know, but we treat our dreams as though they're real, and we literally lie awake at night sometimes worried about whether our dreams are going to come true, even though they're often preposterous, you know. And we can be very unhappy because somehow reality didn't fit our dreams. And we can go through our whole lives not experiencing the real beauty of the world. And the potential we have to be really happy because they are sort of like addiction to dreams. And we can also miss things that really aren't noticed by people because they're too caught up in their dreams. So Zen is really about experiencing the world in a different way, and I think with a bigger intelligence. We sort of turn off the dream machine and we start experiencing the world in a different way. And that world, I think, is more connected, more coherent. I mean, if this isn't, I think probably everybody here has had moments of that, you know, where you, during the session, you felt this sense of connection, this sense of you know, maybe you're just sitting on the cushion, you just feel unaccountably happy. You know, I just feel so happy, you know. Or you might just, you know, often when I am in sesshin, I get this wonderful feeling. I don't know, when I got out of college, like most people, most people in America have had a pretty easy life, I think, and I've had a very easy life, and I had these minor traumas, you know, that aren't that important. But one of the things that happened to me when I was in college was my parents got divorced, and it was like a really messy, awful. My parents were never at their best when they were with each other. Let me put it that way. And when they were at their worst, when they were with each other, they could be at their very worst, you know. And so that's really unpleasant to see, to say the least. And when they decided that they were going to get divorced, it was just like a civil war. So it was very, very messy. And, you know, people throwing things at each other, like coffee cups and things. So, my parents sold their house, and they were both sort of living in like these very small apartments. And I would come home from college, and there was really no room for me in either of the apartments, you know. And so it's like all of a sudden I didn't have a house, you know. It was like I felt like I don't really have a home anymore. And when I would go to my father's place, he decided to solve his problems by marrying somebody who was half his age. It was like, I said my father was 50, and the woman he was dating was like a few years older than I was when I was in college. So it's like, oh, were you an English major too? You know. So that was how he dealt with that. So I didn't feel comfortable there, right? And then, you know, my mother was just, you know, in meltdown and very unhappy and so on. So basically, you know, I just had no house. You know, I had no home. You know? I wasn't like homeless on the street, but psychologically, I had no house. You know, we had moved to military bases all my life. So, you know, we'd live 2 years here, 2 years here. So you just get settled into friendships and so on, and you have to move sometimes in the middle of the year. And then you have to go into a strange classroom. And so I had this kind of rootless life, you know, very rootless. And then to top it all off, you know, we had had a house actually very briefly, and then my parents, you know, blew up. And so then, you know, I got out of college, and I decided to do some backpacking out in the Southwest with a friend of mine, Larry Sullivan. And we went out there and we backpacked. And, you know, when we were hiking up in the mountains, I sometimes would just have this feeling, I don't know how to describe it, it's just like I'm home. You know, I'm out in the middle of these mountains, but I just felt so home, like I'm at home, I'm home. And I don't think a home is a place, I think it's this state of connection to the world, you know. Because out there I didn't have any problems, you know, I was just in the moment. You know, I was just trying, you know, get up every day and just walk, you know. And walking is a little bit, hiking is a little bit like meditation, you know. It's There's not much intellectual content. You're just paying attention to what's happening. From the reason you're hiking is to look at things, right? So you're up there in the mountains and you're just looking, and it's like you're just in this mode of a sort of attentiveness to the present. And actually, if you're hiking, it's actually rather difficult to get lost in thought, you know? You have to pay attention to where you're, but you don't want to be in thought. You want to be in the world, you know? That's why you're there. And it's a little like meditation, you know? You're hiking, you go looking. Your legs hurt, it's a little bit like meditation that way. You know, you're tired at the end of the day, same food every day, you know? I think the discipline of the meditation of hiking, you know, really put me in touch with the world. And I would have these moments that where they had no message. There wasn't a message. But I just felt so connected. I felt so safe and whole and alive, you know. And I felt like I was home. And I would get that feeling at Sesshin, you know. I mean, like everybody else, I had very big problems with Sesshin for, as I always say, the first 10 years are the hardest, right? You know? I think that's true. The next 20 are like gravy, you know? It's just great, you know? The first 10 are hard, you know? And maybe 12, 13, I don't know. But eventually, very pleasant. Eventually, the hardest part is not the physical aspect. It's breaking through the psychological barriers that the koan asks you to go through. You know. So initially, it's just survival is the issue, right? So it's just getting through the next sit and staying and not getting in your car and driving away. You know. And so those are the battles that happen. But eventually it's the psychological battles, right? Those are the difficult ones. We're working through our obstacles, and they have many different forms, and those are very difficult. But eventually it's just a paradise, you know? But I used to have these, you know, I used to get... it would just be like, I would get so sick, it seemed like, at every sesshin. And I always used to have like these giant, I'm one of these people who gets cold sores, you know. So on my lips, and I would get these giant cold sores at every sesshin, you know. So I would always bring cold sore medicine to sesshin, you know. And I can just remember running around, you know, cleaning the floors or something with a big cold sore on my lip, you know, for like 8 years or something. And I would always seem like I was sick, you know. I was always had my legs hurt. I would, you know, and so on and so on. But I would still have these moments where I just felt so connected, and like this is my home, you know. This is my home. And it is my home, you know. It is my home. I think you've probably had moments at this session where you've had that same experience, you know. The more you go there, the easier it is to get back. You know, that will be true. That will be true. Now, you know, session is challenging because we do have, you know, there's not just the physical issue. But there's the mental issue, you know, the mental problem. Sometimes people come in to see me during Dokusan, and one of the things I've heard many times, especially from relatively new people, somebody will come into Dokusan, maybe at first sesshin or second sesshin, and say, you know, I think my sitting is deeper at home, you know. And this is not an unintelligent comment at all. It's a very interesting comment. Because, you know, when you're practicing on, say, a Thursday night, you come from your work or from school, we all get together, I guess they're Wednesday nights, you know. I'll get that right. I'll get that right around the same time I start writing 2008 on the checks, right? Which is about July. You know? So, So we all come on a Thursday night or Wednesday night, and we sit, and we have a wonderful sit, and you feel relaxed and calm. Now you come into Sesshin, and you might not feel relaxed and calm, right? And you might initially have like a day two, your mind is very empty and blank, and then maybe day three, all of this stuff comes up, you know, and you think, well, I do better at home, right? But please don't be deceived by this. This is such a common perception. But there's a big difference between what you can see on a Thursday night and what you can be aware of after 3 days of meditation. So the perspective of somebody practicing for an hour and a half on a Wednesday night is really, even though it feels serene and wonderful, the awareness is not very large. It's just not. And when you come here and you focus, you make the mind still, and your awareness is growing. It might not feel that way, but you know your senses are much. I believe this. Your senses are much sharper. And your mental processing is more extensive, in my opinion. And even though you might feel like your head is a block of wood, that's just an unfamiliar mental state. You know, really and truly, I think people are more intelligent at Sesshin than they are in their ordinary lives. There's fewer distractions. People are more intelligent when they don't watch TV while they're doing something, you know. Studies have shown that really, there's been research that says, you know, when kids watch TV and do their homework, this is the American way of doing homework, you know? And this is why we're like last in math and things like this, because you can't learn anything when you do that, right? And you can't notice anything when you're watching the mental TV, right? You can't watch it, you can't learn when you're watching the mental TV. So when we turn off the mental TV, you know, it becomes possible to be more intelligent, you know, and to notice a great deal more, you know, a great deal more. The things that ordinary people don't ever notice. Please, it's okay to be skeptical, but just remember the elephants, okay? That common sense says elephants can't communicate, mice don't sing, you know, but we just can't hear them sing. And it is true, there are things that aren't true. You know, I'm not saying believe anything that anybody says, you know. So for example, years ago in our Zendo in Seattle, this guy came in with his kids. He was a martial arts teacher. And he had like two or three he was a very handsome man. He had a beard and he was an American martial arts and some martial arts, and he had two or three sons who were like very, you know, handsome, broad-shouldered, you know, very physically trim, and they all came to sit, you know, they all came to sit in the Zendo. And I thought, my God, a whole family coming to sit, you know, that's just great. And anyway, you know, I struck up a conversation with this guy at one point, and then it was like, oh no, you know, because he said, you know, basically he told me that, you know, I teach martial arts, but I'm really into this. And he showed me this book, and it's all about the aliens among us, you know. Really, I'm not kidding. It was like, he said, these are real photos of UFOs. He said, the government doesn't want you to see these, you know. Really, I'm not making this up, you know. I was like, oh, no, you know. And, you know, the pie plates. They were like the pie plates right up in the air. You know, look, this is real. This is an unretouched photograph. It's like the Frisbees and stuff. You know? He's like, that's, you know. And he said, the government doesn't. He said, it's all on Roswell. You know, it's all at Roswell. You know, and he said, you know, I swear this is the truth. I swear. I mean, you take a vow, right? One of the vows you take is not to lie, you know, and I don't always manage to tell exactly the truth, but this is the truth, the guys thought Zen people were probably in communication with the So apparently there's some guy in Switzerland who's at the heart of this whole thing, and in the back of the book there's this picture of this Swiss guy with a long beard, and he's the one who communicates with the aliens. And you know, it's one of these things, you know, that we're in, the Zen people know all about this. It was just like, oh darn, you know, I had had a fantasy about him and his family, right? And this was the reality. And I think eventually they confronted Genki-san, and he just said, I don't know anything about aliens. I took him to see E.T., by the way. But he was totally bored, right? He didn't like it. He snoozed through it, yeah. He liked the Japanese movies that were very, he liked Japanese melodramas, right? So, we went to see this thing called, it was called Sambokan 8. And it was about this woman who's sold into prostitution or something, and she's a wonderful, pure-hearted woman, and her brother tries to save her, and I think there were gangsters in it or something. It's just, you know, and she's being carried away, and their hands are stretched out, and I looked over, and Genki's, the tears. Really, it was just like, he was just weeping, that poor girl. So anyway, that was a big disappointment when I discovered that this guy was into UFOs, and when he discovered that Genki was not communicating with them, and then he left and we didn't see him again. But there are some beliefs that are not true. And of course, if you sit on the cushion long enough, you will never have communication from extraterrestrials. It'll never happen. If it happens, you come and tell me, right? But so far, no transmissions, right? and so that doesn't happen. No ghosts. Yeah? No, there are no ghosts, you know. There's ghosts in the mind of human beings, but you will never encounter a ghost when you're meditating on the cushion, you know, ever. And so on and so on. So, you know, when you're in Mushin, Mushin is like a touchstone, right? By going to Mushin, you can gradually peel away the layers of illusion. And it's hard work, because we dearly want to hold on to some of those fantasies, right? You know, we dearly want to sometimes, or we can't get out because even though we're unhappy, we're so stuck in the rut, you know. So it can take a long time, to see things as they really are. And a lot of Zen koans are not just asking you to be aware with your eyes and your ears, but some koans are asking you to activate your whole body, you know? So the whole body is intelligent. The whole body is providing, experiencing the world at this moment. And so the Zen, yesterday I said, or the day before I said, that, you know, the whole point of Zen is to bring to life the whole being, you know, much of which is like in a kind of sleep. You know the wonderful story. It's like the the human being is in a kind of sleep, much of the human being, and it has been put to sleep, in various ways, but the Zen project is to bring it awake, all of it. And that means the whole being, the whole person. And, if you just keep sitting, if you just keep working through these barriers, though it's hard work, I truly believe you will feel much better. You know, you'll be much happier. And I'm sure you've had moments like that here. And if you keep going, you won't be disappointed. If you've had pain in your legs, please don't imagine that it's anything worse than what I have felt in my life. Or if you are, struggling with fatigue, please don't imagine that I haven't been there too, you know. And so on and so on. Or self-doubt, self-loathing, you're not alone, you know, you're not alone. And yet, you know, I get up, even though it seems crazy, I wish we had two more days, you know, I really do. This is just too fast, you know, and I get up every morning looking forward to my zazen. I just love this way because it makes me feel alive and connected. I love that feeling of being home, yeah. Please build on the practice you've done here in your daily life also. And if you've encountered obstacles at Sesshin that you haven't worked through, you know, don't be daunted by them. You know, continue to make the effort. You know, you won't be disappointed. When you leave here at the end of the day, you may have an experience like this. You're very serene and focused now, very clear. You've been struggling to wake up from your illusions, and you've made real progress. So then you get in the car and you drive home, and in 2 days you'll be back in school, or you'll be back in your job, and all these familiar patterns begin to reassert themselves. And maybe you're in your office and it's just a madhouse, right? And you can feel your calm slipping away, you know. All I can say is, you know, eventually that won't happen. You know, eventually, you know, event, you know, this, you know, eventually that won't happen. And you will be able to make a tremendous contribution to, you know, you will be able to help other people enormously when that day comes. You know, because most people are in their dream, they're in a kind of perpetual dream state, and they're on the edge of hysteria a lot of the time. You know, honestly, if you could hook people's brains up to TVs and show what's in their brains, you would realize it's like a crazy world, right? And people are constantly fearful, agitated, angry, blah, blah, blah. You don't have to look far to see it. A person who is able to be, you know, in the world and not like that has a big impact on people. You might not think so, but people are so frightened and agitated that one person who's very calm can have a huge impact. You know, it can be hugely important. You know. But you have to really spend a lot of time with your true nature in Sesshin, you have to spend a lot of time in that calm state. Eventually, it's not going to go away. You know, but in the meantime, it's helpful to realize that you can bring that. I love Gandhi. You know, Gandhi was so interesting because. When India was getting its independence from Great Britain, you know, there were lots of people who had been to Oxford and so on, who had this idea that, you know, the British are leaving, we've got to get the country in shape, and there's so much to be done. We've got to set up the ministry of this, and the ministry of that, and the ministry of this, and we've got to have elections, and we've got to have you know, we've got to codify the law, the legal system, and decide how much of British law we want to keep, and so on. And we they began to think about what had to be done. It was so enormous an undertaking, right? And so everybody's running around like crazy, but Gandhi's not, you know. Gandhi's, he's at his ashram, he's at his house, basically, and he gets up in the morning and he says his prayers and he does his meditation, and then he spins cotton, and then he takes a bath and he has a meal, and then he, meets with a few people, and he takes care of some animals and does some gardening. And it's like, are you out of your mind? There's so much to do. But you know, the thing is, people flocked to Gandhi. You know, they could have gone to any number of specialists and bureaucrats and said, you know, how do we... But what they really needed was this. You know, what they were so hungry for was somebody who can be awake and who's not buffeted by these waves, you know. Somebody whose mind is placid like a lake and who isn't driven by neurotic compulsions, right, but is able to just be present and because of that is able to be compassionate. You know, and so really, Gandhi, by doing very little, had an enormous impact on the world. And I think this is how I think these very rare humans are able to have so much impact, because they, you know, their presence is felt, you know, like a deafening silence, right? You know, you meet such people all the time, you know, people who. I mean, they're not everywhere, but you do, in your life, you will meet people who are able to be calm and who are able to be compassionate. And you have to be that person. If nobody else is going to be that person, you need to be that person. And Gandhi said you have to be the change you want to see in the world. And I think that's so important. You have to be that calm. You have to, and you can say, but I'm not that calm. But it's right there. It's in you. If it's not in you, it's nowhere. But you found it at this session. So instead of seeing yourself in the workplace as like beleaguered person, you can see yourself as a giver of calm. You know, you can be the giver of calm. You know. There, if you've ever seen the wonderful ox herding pictures that come from Chinese Zen, these pictures are a person pursuing an ox and looking for the ox, finding the ox, and then trying to tame the ox. This is all about different stages of Zen training. The ox, you could say, is your mind. Eventually, Daikensho is represented by an empty circle. But that's not the end of the story, because the last caption shows a monk coming into the village with a big bag of goodies over his shoulder, like Santa Claus. Right? And the point is that he, you know, even though he has nothing, he has everything to give. I mean, Gandhi too had nothing, you know. Really, he didn't have anything. He had the clothes he made himself, you know, but he gave so much to people, and what he could give to them was this wonderful calm. So if you don't do sesshin, and you don't practice meditation, you can imagine yourself as calm all you want, but you won't be calm. But, you know, if you come to sesshin and you clean up your karma, it has a change, you know, over you. It has an effect. And as you go through your life, you don't have to, you know, sit there with a smile on your face like, like a, you know, the cat that ate the canary, like, I've got a secret, you know. I've been to Soshin, you know, I know it all, you know, I'm the wise one here, you know. That would be silly, right? But sometimes you get up in the morning and you do your meditation and you go to work and you can find that place, you can find it. You can't, if they're having a conference, if they're having a conference in the conference room, you can't stand up and go, moo. Or I wouldn't recommend it anyway, you could, but. But nevertheless, you can be saying moo, moo. You know, this is called the lotus growing in the fire, right? So you have to do daily practice and you have to come to Sesshin. But when you go into the world, your part of your training is to cultivate this mu mind in your daily activities. And if you don't do sitting on a regular basis and you don't do sesshin, you can't do it. It's just another fantasy. But if you can get to this place after 5 days, or after 7 days, when you go out into the world, you don't have to try to be, I'm not saying try to be a special person. Please don't. We have enough special people. What I'm saying is, please use this calm to help others, because they're desperate for the help. You know, desperate. You know, one calm person is like an oasis. You know, in a desert of confusion. You know, so don't imagine that when you leave here, you're going to be beleaguered, overwhelmed. That too is just a story you tell about yourself. You know, when you leave here, you're taking something out into the world that's very, very, I can't help it. Imagine what would happen if we had a president who was like Gandhi and instead of the one we've got. Can you imagine? I mean, it makes me want to cry. You know, what a world. If we had a president like Ashoka, right? Imagine what somebody like that could do with the power and wealth that the United States has. What if we waged peace? Really? You know, wouldn't the world would be an amazing, we're building up our arms. We've started a new arms race in the United States. You know, imagine if we hadn't done that. All the money spent. So, you know, you may not be president of Europe, you know, like the guy in the James Joyce book, or the president of Israel, like that comedian, or the president of the United States, but you can make a big difference in the world just by continuing to practice mushin, yeah? And and as I said before, you know, you don't need many parts per million. You know, people will be very. When the Buddha had his great awakening, it was an amazing experience. His Kensho usually lasts a number of days. It's difficult to know how many because you're not counting the days, right? But you know, it's usually a bit of a blur. The intensity of the experience eventually wears off. And the Buddha is supposed to have had a Kensho that lasted really like 7 days. And at the end of it, he thought to himself, my God, you know, nobody is going to understand this. You know, this is so, the Buddha used to say, I swim against the stream, meaning, I don't believe in common sense. You know, everybody goes this way, and I say, I'm not going that way, right? So, you know, the Buddha, he left his family. You know, to cultivate, this is like a, you know, it would be scandalous here in Asia. This is like criminal, right? I mean, this is like unthinkable. So the Buddha, you know, he challenged common sense in every possible way. You know? At the end of his Great Awakening experience, you know, he said, "My God, nobody will ever understand this. This is like unteachable." Because if people were supposed to understand this, what they would have to do is meditate every day and go to retreats 4 or 5 times a year and do sesshin, right? And nobody's going to do that, right? You know? Because it was hard enough for me. And in the legend, a god appeared before the Buddha named Sahampati. And Sahampati said, you know, the world is so unhappy. You know, please help us. And so the Buddha did. He said, I will, immediately. You know, so the point is, you know, the Sahampati, I don't really think there is a god named Sahampati. Mm-hmm. But although it's a cool name, don't you think? what it really means is that it was a thought or an idea or a recognition in the Buddha's mind that was very lofty recognition that this is a suffering world, and so our job is to help other people, and you don't have to be you don't have to be living in Watts. Working in a food kitchen, you know, or something like that, or if that's what you want to do, that's wonderful. But you can be, on your job, whatever your job is, or you could be at school. You know, and if you just cultivate to this mind, it will have a spillover effect, you know. And so please think about that. You know, you're not, it's a crazy world, but you're not at a disadvantage. In a crazy world, you have a tremendous advantage because you're a little bit saner right now than everybody else. And that's the truth. That's the truth. It's not nothing to brag about, right? Like it's easily lost, you know, and you have to keep working at it. But there's a difference between somebody who spent the last 5 days watching TV and somebody who spent the last 5 days purifying body, mind, and heart. It is a democracy, that's true, but not all people are equally sane. And not all, that's true, right? That's true. We know this because of our president, right? And not all people are equally healthy, we know that. Not all people are in equally good physical shape. So it's not a matter of, it's not going out of here with a big sense of superiority. It's we have all seen our limitations very keenly, right? We've all seen our fears, our terrors, our anxieties. We know they're still there. We have a lot of work to do. Not Buddhas today, right? So you can't go out with too big of a big head, you know. But on the other hand, can be very helpful. First, we have to help ourselves. It's very important. If you're not a little sane, you can't help others. So first help yourself. Wake up a little bit, and then you can help other people. You don't have to do anything special. Just, you know, try to be kind to people.